Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The Black Monk and Other Stories by Anton Chekhov, narrated by George Guidel. This recording is copyrighted 1993 by Recorded Books Incorporated. Anton Pavlovich Chekhov was born in Taganrog in southern Russia in 1860. He studied medicine at the University of Moscow and got his degree in 1884, but practiced very little. As a young man, he wrote hundreds of enormously popular comic sketches for the humorous newspapers. His success gave him the opportunity to devote his time to writing. By the late 1880s, his style had matured, and he began to produce the short stories and plays which are to this day considered among the most distinguished examples of the form, vividly portraying the realities and frustrations of Russian life. The stories in this collection are among his most famous, and were originally published from 1894 through 1899. And now, the first story, The Black Monk.
Chapter 1. Nerves. Andrei Vasilich Kovrin, Master of Arts, was overworked and nervous. He was not being treated, but one day while sitting with a doctor at wine, he happened casually to speak about his health. The physician advised him to pass the spring and summer in the country. Opportunely, he received then a long letter from Tanya Persotsky inviting him to visit Borisovka. He decided that he really required a change. It was April. He went to his family estate of Kovrinka for 3 weeks. Then, the roads being clear, he started on wheels to see his former guardian and tutor, Persotsky, the great horticulturist. From Kovrinka to Borisovka, where the Persotskys lived, it was only 70 versts, and it was a pleasure to take the drive. Igor Semyonich Persotsky's house was huge, with columns and lions, but the plaster was cracking. The old park, severe and gloomy, laid out in the English style, extended for nearly a verst from the house to the river, and finished in abruptly precipitous clayey banks on which there grew old pines with bare roots that looked like shaggy paws. Down below the water glittered unsociably, and snipe flitted along its surface with plaintive cries. When there you always had the feeling that you must sit down and write a ballad. However, near the house, in the courtyard and in the fruit orchard, which together with the nurseries covered about 30 acres, it was gay and cheerful even in bad weather. Such wonderful roses, lilies and camellias, such tulips of all imaginable hues, beginning with brilliant white and finishing with tints as black as soot. Such a wealth of flowers as Persotsky possessed, Kovrin had never seen in any other place. It was only the beginning of spring, and the real luxuriance of the flower beds was still hidden in the hothouses. But even those which blossomed in the borders along the walks and here and there on the flower beds were sufficient to make you feel, when you passed through the garden, that you were in the kingdom of delicate tints, especially in the early morning, when a dewdrop glistened brightly on each petal. The decorative part of the garden, which Persotsky called contemptuously a mere trifle, had greatly impressed Kovrin in his childhood. What wonderful whimsicalities were to be found there! What far-fetched monstrosities and mockeries of nature! There were espaliers of fruit trees, pear trees that had the form of pyramidal poplars, oaks and limes shaped like balls, an umbrella made of an apple tree, arches, monograms, candelabra, and even 1862, formed by a plum tree. This date denoted the year when Persotsky first began to occupy himself with horticulture. There you also found pretty, graceful trees with straight, strong stems like palms, and only when you examined them closely you saw that they were gooseberries and currants. But what chiefly made the garden pay and produced an animated appearance was the constant movement in it. From early morning till evening, people with wheelbarrows, shovels, and watering pots swarmed like ants round the trees, bushes, avenues, and flower beds. Kovrin arrived at the Pesotskys' in the evening at past 9 o'clock. He found Tanya and her father in a very anxious mood. The clear starlit sky and the falling thermometer foretold a morning frost. The head gardener, Ivan Karlich, had gone to town, and there was nobody who could be relied on. During supper, nothing but morning frost was talked of, and they settled that Tanya was not to go to bed, but walk through the gardens and see if all was in order after midnight, and that her father would get up at 3, or probably earlier. Kovrin sat up with Tanya, and after midnight he went with her into the orchard. It was very cold. In the yard there was a strong smell of burning. In the large orchard, which was called the commercial orchard, and brought Igor Semyonich a clear yearly profit of several thousand rubles, a thick, black, biting smoke spread along the earth, and by enveloping the trees saved those thousands from the frost. The trees were planted here in regular rows like the squares of a chessboard, and they looked like ranks of soldiers. This strictly pedantical regularity, together with the exact size and similarity of the stems and crowns of the trees, made the picture monotonous and dull. Kovrin and Tanya passed along the rows, where bonfires of manure, straw, and all sorts of refuse were smoldering, and occasionally they met workmen, who were wandering about in the smoke like shadows. Only plums, cherries, and some sorts of apple trees were in full blossom, but the whole orchard was smothered in smoke, and it was only when they reached the nurseries that Kovrin could draw a long breath. "From my childhood the smoke here has made me sneeze," he said, shrugging his shoulders. "But I still do not understand how this smoke can protect the trees from frost." "The smoke takes the place of clouds when they are absent," Tanya answered. "Why are clouds necessary?" "In dull and cloudy weather there is never night frost." "Really?" He laughed and took her hand. Her broad, serious, cold face, with its finely marked black eyebrows, the high turned-up collar of her coat, which prevented her from moving her head with ease, her whole thin, svelte figure, with skirts well tucked up to protect them from the dew, affected him. "Good Lord, she's already grown up," he said. "When I last drove away from here 5 years ago, you were still quite a child. You were a thin, long-legged, bare-headed girl in short petticoats. And I teased you, and called you the heron. What time does?" "Yes, 5 years," Tanya sighed. "Much water has flowed away since then." "Tell me, Andryusha, quite candidly," she said rapidly, looking into his face, "have we become strangers to you? But why should I ask? You're a man, you are now living your own interesting life, you are great. Estrangement is so natural. But, however it may be, Andryusha, I want you to consider us as your own people. We have that right." "Of course you have, Tanya." "Honor bright?" "Yes, honor bright." "You were surprised today to see we had so many of your portraits. You know my father adores you. Sometimes I think that he loves you more than he does me. He is proud of you. You are a scholar, an extraordinary man. You have made a brilliant career. And he is convinced that you have become all that because he brought you up. I do not prevent him from thinking this. Let him.
The day began to break. This was chiefly to be noticed by the distinctness with which the clouds of smoke were perceptible in the air, and the bark of the trees became visible. Nightingales were singing, and the cry of the quail was borne from the fields.
"It's time to go to bed now," Tanya said. "How cold it is!"
She took his arm.
"Thank you, Andryusha, for coming. We have but few acquaintances here, and they are not interesting. We have nothing but the garden, the garden, the garden, nothing but that. Standard, half-standard," she laughed. "Pippins, rennets, codlins, grafting, budding, all our life has gone into the garden. I never dream of anything but apples and pears. Of course, all this is good and useful, but sometimes I wish for something else for variety. I remember when you used to come for the holidays, or simply on a visit, the house seemed to grow fresher and lighter. It was as if the covers had been taken off the lusters and the chairs. I was a child then, still I understood."
She talked for a long time, and with great feeling.
Suddenly the idea entered his head that in the course of the summer he might become attached to this little, weak, loquacious creature.
He might be carried away and fall in love. In their position it was so possible and so natural. This thought amused and moved him. He bent over her charming, troubled face and began to sing in a low voice, "Onegin, I'll not hide from you. I love Tatyana madly."
When they reached the house, Igor Semyonich was already up. Kovrin did not want to sleep. He began to talk with the old man, and he returned with him to the garden. Igor Semyonich was a tall, broad-shouldered man with a large stomach. He suffered from breathlessness, but he always walked so fast that it was difficult to keep up with him. He always had an extremely worried look, and he was always hurrying somewhere with an expression that seemed to say if he were too late by 1 minute even, all would be lost.
"Here's a strange thing, my dear fellow," he said, stopping to take breath. "It's freezing on the ground, as you see. But if you raise the thermometer on a stick about 14 feet above earth, it's warm there. Why is it?"
"I really don't know," Kovrin said, laughing.
Of course one can't know everything. However vast a man's understanding may be, it can't comprehend everything. You've chiefly gone in for philosophy?"
"Yes, I lecture on psychology, but I study philosophy in general."
"And it does not bore you?"
"On the contrary, it's my very existence."
"Well, may God prosper your work,"
Igor Semyonich exclaimed, and he stroked his grey whiskers reflectively.
"God prosper you. I'm very glad for you. Very glad indeed, my boy."
Suddenly he seemed to listen. An expression of anger passed over his face, and he ran off to one side and was soon lost to sight among the trees in the clouds of smoke.
"Who has tethered a horse to an apple tree?" his despairing, heart-rending cry could be heard. "What villain and scoundrel has dared to tie a horse to an apple tree? Good God, good God, they have dirtied, spoiled, damaged, ruined it. The orchard is lost. The orchard is destroyed. My God!"
When he returned to Kovrin, he looked worn out and insulted.
"What can you do with this accursed people?" he said in a plaintive voice, clasping his hands. "Stepka was carting manure during the night, and has tied his horse to an apple tree. The villain tied the reins so tight round it that the bark has been rubbed in 3 places. What do you think of that? I spoke to him, and he only stood open-mouthed, blinking his eyes. He ought to be hanged."
When he was somewhat calmer, he embraced Kovrin and kissed him on the cheek.
"Well, God help you, God help you," he mumbled. "I'm very glad you've come, delighted beyond words. Thank you."
Then he went round the whole garden at the same rapid pace and with the same troubled expression, and showed his former ward all the hothouses, conservatories, and fruit-sheds, also his two apiaries, which he called the wonder of the century. While they were walking round, the sun rose and shed its brilliant rays over the garden. It became warm. Foreseeing a bright, joyous, and long day, Kovrin remembered it was only the beginning of May, and that the whole summer lay before them, also bright, joyous, and long. And suddenly, a gladsome, youthful feeling was aroused in his breast, like he used to have when running about that garden in his childhood. He embraced the old man and kissed him tenderly. They were both much affected as they went into the house, where they drank tea with cream out of old china cups, and ate rich, satisfying cracknels. These trifles again reminded Kovrin of his childhood and youth. The beautiful present and the memories that were aroused in him of the past were blended together. His soul was full and rejoiced. He waited for Tanya to get up and had coffee with her, and then a walk, after which he went into his own room and sat down to work. He read with attention, made notes, only raising his eyes from time to time to look out of the open window, or at the fresh flowers, still wet with dew, that were in a vase on his table. And then he again lowered his eyes to his book. And it appeared to him that every nerve in his system vibrated with satisfaction. Chapter 2. A Pale Face. In the country, he continued to lead the same nervous and restless life as in town. He read and wrote very much. He learned Italian. And when he was walking, he thought all the time of the pleasure he would have in sitting down to work again. Everybody was astonished how little he slept. If he happened to doze for half an hour during the day, he would afterwards not sleep all night. And after a sleepless night, he felt himself active and gay, as if nothing had happened. He talked much, drank wine, and smoked expensive cigars. Often, indeed almost every day, some young girls from a neighboring estate, friends of Tanya's, came to the Pisotskis. They played on the piano and sang together. Sometimes another neighbor, a young man who played the violin very well, came too. Kovrin listened to the music and singing with avidity, and he was quite overcome by it, which was evidenced by his eyes closing and his head sinking on one side. One day after the evening tea, he was sitting on the balcony reading. At that time Tanya, a soprano, one of her friends, a contralto, and the young man playing on his violin were practicing Braga's celebrated serenade. Kovrin tried to make out the words. They were Russian, and he was quite unable to understand their meaning. At last, laying his book aside and listening attentively, he understood. A girl with a diseased imagination heard one night mysterious sounds in the garden, which were so wonderfully beautiful and strange that she thought they were holy harmonies, but so incomprehensible for us mortals that they ascended again to heaven. Once more Kovrin's eyes began to close. He rose, and feeling quite exhausted, he began to walk about the drawing-room and then about the dancing-hall. When they stopped singing, he took Tanya's arm and led her on to the balcony. "Ever since the morning, an old legend has been running in my head," he said. "I don't remember if I read it or whether it was told me, but the legend is a strange one and not like any other. To begin with, it's not very clear. 1,000 years ago, a certain monk, clad in black, was walking in the desert somewhere in Syria or Arabia. A few miles from the place where he was walking, some fishermen saw another black monk moving slowly across the surface of a lake. This other monk was a mirage. Now you must forget all the laws of optics, which the legend evidently does not admit, and listen to the continuation. From the mirage, another mirage was obtained, and from that one a third, so that the image of the black monk was reproduced without end in one sphere of the atmosphere after another. He was seen sometimes in Africa, sometimes in Spain, sometimes in India, then again in the far north. At last, he went beyond the bounds of the Earth's atmosphere, and is now wandering over the whole universe, always unable to enter into the conditions where he would be able to disappear. Perhaps at present he may be seen somewhere on Mars or on some star of the Southern Cross. But, my dear, the main point, the very essence of the whole legend, consists in this, that exactly 1,000 years from the time the monk was walking in the desert, the mirage will again be present in the atmosphere of the world, and it will show itself to men. It appears that those 1,000 years are nearly accomplished. Accordingly to the legend, we can expect the black monk either today or tomorrow. A strange mirage, Tanya said. She did not like the legend. But the strangest thing is that I can't remember from where this legend has got into my head, Corinne said, laughing. Have I read it? Was it told me? Or perhaps I have dreamed about the black monk? By God, I can't remember, but the legend interests me. I think of it all day long. Allowing Tanya to return to her guests, he left the house, and plunged in meditation. He passed along the flower beds. The sun was already setting. The flowers, perhaps because they had just been watered, exhaled a moist, irritating odor. In the house they had again begun to sing, and at that distance the fiddle sounded like a human voice. Corinne, straining his memory to remember where he had heard or read the legend, bent his steps towards the park, walking slowly, and imperceptibly he arrived at the river. Running down the steep footpath that passed by the bare roots, he came to the water, disturbing some snipe and frightening a pair of ducks. Some of the tops of the gloomy pines were still illuminated by the rays of the setting sun, but on the surface of the river evening had already settled down. Corinne crossed the footbridge to the other bank. Before him lay a wide field of young rye, not yet in flower. Neither a human habitation nor a living soul was to be seen near or far, and it seemed as if this footpath, if only you went far enough along it, would lead to that unknown, mysterious place into which the sun had just descended, and where the glorious blaze of the evening brightness was still widespread. What space! What freedom! What quiet is here! Corinne thought as he went along the footpath. It seemed as if the whole world was looking at me, dissembling and waiting, that I should understand it. But just then, waves passed over the rye, and a light wind touched his bare head. A minute later there was again a gust of wind, but a stronger one. The rye began to rustle, and behind it the dull murmur of the pines was heard. Corinne stopped in amazement. On the horizon, something like a whirlwind or a waterspout, a high black column stretched from the earth to the sky. Its outlines were indistinct. From the first minute it was evident that it did not remain on one spot, but was moving with terrible rapidity, moving straight towards Corinne. And the nearer it came, the smaller and clearer it became. Corinne rushed to one side into the rye to make room for it, and he had scarcely time to do so. A monk, clad in black, with a grey head and black eyebrows, his arms crossed on his breast, was borne past him. His bare feet did not touch the earth. He had already passed Kovrin for a distance of about 12 feet when he looked back at him, nodded his head, and smiled affably, but at the same time, cunningly. What a pale, a terribly pale and thin face! Again beginning to grow larger, he flew across the river, struck noiselessly against the clay bank and the pines, and, passing through them, disappeared like smoke. "Well, you see," Kovrin mumbled, "so the legend is true." Without trying to explain to himself this strange apparition, but feeling pleased that he had chanced to be so close, and had seen so distinctly not only the black garb, but even the monk's face and eyes, he returned home in pleasant agitation. In the park and the gardens, people were quietly moving about. In the house, they were playing. That meant he alone had seen the monk. He was very anxious to tell Tanya and Igor Semyonich all he had seen, but he thought that they would certainly consider his words mere nonsense, and it would frighten them. It was best to remain silent. He laughed loudly. He sang and danced the mazurka. He was gay, and everybody, the guests and Tanya, thought that his face had never looked so radiant and inspired, and that he certainly was a most interesting man. Chapter 3 She Loves. After supper, when their guests had departed, he went to his room and lay down on the sofa. He wanted to think about the monk. But a minute later, Tanya entered the room. "Here, Andryusha, are some of Father's articles. Read them," she said, giving him a parcel of pamphlets and proofs. "They are splendid articles. He writes very well." "Well, indeed," said Igor Semyonich with a forced laugh, following her into the room. He was confused. "Don't listen to her, please, and don't read them. However, if you want to go to sleep, you may as well read them. They are excellent soporifics." "I think them excellent articles," Tanya said with deep conviction. "Read them, Andryusha, and persuade Papa to write oftener. He might write a whole course of horticulture." Igor Semyonich forced a laugh, blushed, and began to say such phrases as confused authors are wont to say. At last he gave in. "If you must, then first read this article by Gaucher and these Russian notices," he murmured, turning the pamphlets over with trembling hands, "or else you won't understand it. Before reading my refutation, you must know what I refute. However, it's all nonsense, and very dull. Besides, I should say it's time to go to bed." Tanya left the room. Igor Semyonich sat down on the sofa next to Kovrin and sighed deeply. "Yes, my dear fellow," he began after a short silence, "so it is, my most amiable master of arts. Here am I writing articles, taking part in exhibitions, receiving medals. People say Pesotsky has apples the size of a man's head. People say Pesotsky has made a fortune by his orchards and gardens. In a word, Kochubey is rich and famous. Query, to what does all this lead? The garden is really beautiful, a model garden. It is not simply a garden, it is an institution, possessing great importance for the empire because it is, so to speak, a step in a new era of Russian economy, of Russian industry. But what for? For what object? The business speaks for itself." "That is not what I mean. I ask, what will become of the gardens when I die? In the condition you see it now, it will not exist for a single month without me. The whole secret of its success is not because the garden is large and there are many laborers, but because I love the work. You understand? I love it. Perhaps more than my own self. Look at me. I do everything myself. I work from morning to night. I do all the grafting myself. I do all the pruning myself, all the planting, everything. When I am assisted, I am jealous and irritable to rudeness. The whole secret lies in love, that is, in the vigilant master's eye, in the master's hand, too, in the feeling that when you go anywhere to pay a visit of an hour, you sit there and your heart is not easy. You're not quite yourself. You're afraid something may happen in the garden. When I die, who will look after it all? Who will work? A gardener? Workmen? Yes, I tell you, my good friend, the chief enemy in our business is not the hare, not the cockchafer, not the frost, but the stranger. But Tanya? Kovrina asked, laughing. She can't be more injurious than the hare. She loves and understands the business. Yes, she loves and understands it. If after my death she gets the garden and becomes the mistress, I could wish for nothing better. But if, God forbid it, she should get married? Igor Semyonich whispered and looked at Kovrin with alarm. That's just what I fear. She gets married, children arrive, and then there's no time to think of the garden. What I chiefly fear is that she'll get married to some young fellow who'll be stingy and will let the garden to some tradesman. And the whole place will go to the devil in the first year. In our business, women are the scourge of God. Igor Semyonich sighed and was silent for a few moments. Perhaps it is egoism, but to speak frankly, I don't want Tanya to marry. I'm afraid. There's a young fop with a fiddle who comes here and scrapes at it. I know very well Tanya will not marry him. I know it very well, but I can't bear him. In general, dear boy, I'm a great oddity. I confess it. Igor Semyonich rose and paced about the room for some time, much agitated. It was evident that he wanted to say something very important, but couldn't make up his mind to do so. I love you very much, and will speak to you quite frankly, he said at last, and thrust his hands into his pockets. There are certain ticklish subjects I regard quite simply, and I say quite openly what I think of them. I cannot bear so-called hidden thoughts. I say to you plainly, you are the only man I would not be afraid to give my daughter to. You are a clever man, you have a good heart, and you would not allow my cherished work to perish. But the chief reason is, I love you as if you were my son, and I am proud of you. If you and Tanya could settle a little romance between yourselves, why, what then, I would be very glad, very happy. As an honest man, I say this quite openly, without mincing matters. Kovrin laughed. Igor Semyonich opened the door to leave the room, but he stopped on the threshold. If a son were to be born to you and Tanya, I'd make a gardener of him, he said reflectively. However, these are empty thoughts. Sleep well. Left alone, Kovrin lay down more comfortably on the sofa and began to look through the articles. One was entitled, Of Intermediate Culture. Another was called, A Few Words Concerning Mr. Z's Remarks on the Digging Up of Ground for a New Garden. A third was, More About the Budding of Dormant Eyes. They were all of a similar nature. But what an uneasy, uneven tone! What nervous, almost unhealthy passion! Here was an article one would suppose of the most peaceful nature, and on the most indifferent subject. It was about the Russian Antonov apple.
However, Igor Semyonich began with Audiatur altera pars, and finished Sapiente sat. And between these two quotations there was quite a fountain of various poisonous words addressed to the learned ignorance of our qualified gardeners who observe nature from the height of their cathedras. Or else Monsieur Gaucher, whose success has been created by the unlearned and the dilettante.
Here again, quite out of place, was an insincere regret that it was now no longer possible to flog the peasants who stole fruit and broke the trees. The work is pretty, charming, healthy, but even here are passions and war, Kovrin thought. It must be that everywhere and in all arenas of human activity, intellectual people are nervous and remarkable for their heightened sensitiveness. Apparently this is necessary. He thought of Tanya, who was so delighted with her father's articles. She was small, pale, and so thin that her collarbones were visible. She had dark, wide-open, clever eyes that were always looking into something, searching for something. Her gait was short-stepped and hurried like her father's. She spoke much. She liked to argue. And then even the most unimportant phrase was accompanied by expressive looks and gestures. She certainly was nervous to the highest degree. Kovrin continued to read, but he could understand nothing. So he threw the book away. The same pleasant excitement he had felt when he danced the mazurka and listened to the music now overcame him again and aroused in him numberless thoughts. He rose and began to walk about the room, thinking of the black monk. It entered his head that if he alone had seen this strange, supernatural monk, it must be because he was ill and had hallucinations. This reflection alarmed him, but not for long. "But I feel very well, and I do nobody any harm, therefore there is nothing bad in my hallucinations," he thought, and he again felt quite contented. He sat down on the sofa and seized his head in both hands, trying to restrain the incomprehensible joy that filled his whole being. Then he went to the table and began to work. But the thoughts he read in the books didn't satisfy him. He wanted something gigantic, immense, astounding. Towards morning he undressed and reluctantly lay down in bed. He ought to sleep. When he heard Igor Semyonich's footsteps going down to the garden, Kovrin rang the bell and ordered the manservant to bring him some wine. He drank several glasses of Chateau Lafitte with pleasure, and then covered himself up to the head. His senses became dim, and he went to sleep. Chapter 4 Tears of Tanya. Igor Semyonich and Tanya often quarreled and said unpleasant things to each other. One morning they had a quarrel. Tanya began to cry and went to her room. She didn't appear at dinner nor at tea. At first Igor Semyonich went about looking very important and sulky, as if he wished everybody to know that for him the interests of justice and order stood above everything in the world. But soon he was unable to maintain that character and became depressed. He wandered sadly about the park and constantly sighed, "Oh, good God, good God!" At dinner he would not eat a crumb. At last, feeling guilty and having qualms of conscience, he knocked at his daughter's locked door and called to her timidly, "Tanya! Tanya!" And in answer he heard on the other side of the door a weak voice, exhausted with crying, but still very positive, reply, "Leave me alone, I beg you." The master's trouble affected the whole house. Even the people working in the garden were under its influence. Kovrin was immersed in his own interesting work, but at last he too became sad and felt awkward. In order, in some measure, to dissipate the general gloomy mood, he decided to intervene. And early in the evening, he knocked at Tanya's door. He was admitted. Oh, what a shame, he began jokingly, looking with astonishment at Tanya's tear-stained, sad little face that was all covered with red blotches. Is it possible it's so serious? If you only knew how it tortures me, she said, and tears, bitter, plentiful tears, welled up in her large eyes. He has worn me quite out, she continued, wringing her hands. I said nothing to him, nothing at all. I only said there is no need to keep extra workmen if it is possible to get day laborers whenever they are wanted. Why, the workmen have been doing nothing for a whole week. I only said this, and he shouted at me, and he told me many offensive, many deeply insulting things. Why? Enough, Kovrin said as he arranged a lock of her hair. You have abused each other. You have wept, and that's enough. One mustn't be angry for long. That's wrong. All the more because he loves you. Tenderly. He has spoiled my whole life, Tanya continued. I am only insulted and wounded here. He considers me superfluous in his house. What am I to do? He's right. I'll go away from here tomorrow and become a telegraph girl. Let him.
Well, Tanya, don't cry. You mustn't, my dear. You are both hot-headed, irritable, and you are both in fault. Come along, I'll make peace between you.
Kovrin spoke affectionately and persuasively, but she continued to cry, her shoulders shaking and her hands clenched as if a terrible misfortune had befallen her. He was all the more sorry for her because her grief was not serious, yet she suffered deeply. What trifles were sufficient to make this poor creature unhappy for a whole day, yes, perhaps even for her whole life? While comforting Tanya, Kovrin thought that besides this girl and her father, he might search the whole world without being able to find any other people who loved him as one of their family. If it had not been for these two people, perhaps he, who had lost both his parents in his early childhood, would not have known to his very death what sincere affection was, nor that naive, uncritical love that only exists between very near blood relatives. And he felt that his half-diseased, overtaxed nerves were drawn towards the nerves of this weeping, shuddering girl as iron is drawn to the magnet. He could never love a healthy, strong, red-cheeked woman. But pale, fragile, unhappy Tanya attracted him. He was pleased to stroke her hair, pat her shoulders, press her hands, and wipe away her tears. At last she stopped crying. But for a long time she continued to complain about her father, and of her difficult, unbearable life in that house, begging Kovrin to enter into her position. Then she gradually began to smile, and to sigh that God had given her such a bad character, and at last she laughed aloud, called herself a fool, and ran out of the room. Shortly after, when Kovrin went into the garden, Igor Semyonich and Tanya were walking together in the avenue, eating black bread and salt. They were both hungry. As if nothing had happened.
Chapter 5 Red Spots.
Delighted that the part of peacemaker had been successful, Kovrin went into the park. While sitting on a bench, thinking he heard the sound of wheels and of girls' laughter, visitors had arrived. When the shades of evening had begun to settle down in the gardens, faint sounds of a violin and of voices singing reached his ear, and this reminded him of the Black Monk. Where, in what land or on what planet, was that optical incongruity now being born? He had scarcely remembered the legend, and recalled to his memory the dark vision he had seen in the rye field, when just before him a middle-sized man with a bare grey head and bare feet, who looked like a beggar, came silently out of the pine wood, walking with small, unheard steps. On his pale, death-like face, the black eyebrows stood out sharply. Nodding affably, this beggar, or pilgrim, came noiselessly and sat down on the bench. Kovrin recognized in him the Black Monk. For a minute they looked at each other, Kovrin with astonishment, the monk in a kindly and, as on the previous occasion, in a somewhat cunning manner, and with a self-complacent expression. "But you are a mirage," Kovrin exclaimed. "Why are you here and sitting in one place, too? That is not in accordance with the legend." "That's all the same," the monk replied after a pause, in a low, quiet voice, turning his face towards Kovrin. "The mirage, the legend, and I are all the products of your excited imagination. I am a phantom." "Then you don't exist?" Kovrin asked. "Think what you like," the monk answered with a faint smile. "I exist in your imagination, and your imagination is part of nature. Consequently, I exist in nature, too." "You have a very old, clever, and expressive face, just as if you had really existed for more than 1,000 years, Kovrin said. "I didn't know that my imagination was capable of creating such phenomena. But why are you looking at me with such rapture? Do I please you?"
"Yes. You are one of the few who are justly called the chosen of God. You serve the eternal truth. Your thoughts, your intentions, your extraordinary science, and your whole life bear the godlike, the heavenly stamp, as they are devoted to the reasonable and the beautiful, that is to say, to that which is eternal."
"You said the eternal truth. But can people attain to the eternal truth, and is it necessary for them if there is no eternal life?"
"There is eternal life," the monk answered.
"Do you believe in the immortality of man?"
"Yes, of course. A great, brilliant future awaits you men. And the more men like you there are on earth, the sooner this future will be realized. Without you, the servants of the first cause, you who live with discernment and in freedom, the human race would indeed be insignificant. Developing in a natural way, it would long have waited for the end of its earthly history. You are leading it to the kingdom of eternal truth several 1,000 years sooner. And in this lies your great service. You incarnate in yourselves the blessing with which God has honored mankind."
"But what is the object of eternal life?" Kovrin asked.
"The same as of all life. Enjoyment.
true enjoyment is knowledge. And eternal life offers numberless and inexhaustible sources of knowledge. This is the meaning of, "In my Father's house are many mansions." "If you only knew how pleasant it is to listen to you," Kovrin said, rubbing his hands with satisfaction. "I'm very pleased. But I know that when you go away I will be troubled about your reality. You are a vision, a hallucination. Consequently, I am physically ill. I am not normal."
"And what of that? Why are you troubled? You are ill because you have worked beyond your strength and you are exhausted, which means that you have sacrificed your health to an idea. And the time is near when you will sacrifice your life to it, too. What could be better? It is the object to which all noble natures, gifted from above, constantly aspire.
If I know that I am mentally diseased, can I believe in myself?"
"How do you know that the men of genius who are believed in by the whole world have not also seen visions? Scholars say now that genius is allied to insanity. My friend, only the ordinary people, the herd, are quite well and normal. All this consideration about the nervous century, overwork, degeneration, etc., can only seriously alarm those whose object in life is the present. That is, the people of the herd. The Romans said, 'Mens sana in corpore sano.' Not all that the Romans and Greeks said is true. Overstrained